Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to the Premier of Queensland to Sydney, which is very wet one day and extremely wet the next. And I don't need to introduce Anna Bligh. She's one of the best known Australians. So I just say it's great to have the Premier of Queensland here, Anna Bligh, and she's going to talk on a number of issues, including the social media. Premier, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared. Can I thank everybody for their patience and start with a very profuse apology? I did actually leave Woolloomooloo 55 minutes ago, and I rang Jared, and he said, "Oh dear, you're going to be early." So I got out on College Road and walked the rest of the way. So my apologies. Thank you so much for being patient and for waiting. I'll say my words and then I'm happy to take questions, Jared. I think I actually did bring Queensland weather. We've had a lot of this, so I'm used to it. It is a great pleasure for me to be able to be here with members of the Institute, and I thank Jared for the invitation. Right now, the biggest story in the world is news itself, and no doubt there are many here tonight that are feeling a little bleary-eyed after a late-night session this week with Rupert Murdoch, the UK Parliament, and a foam pie. The world has, I think, fair to say, been transfixed by what is an extraordinary story unfolding. Journalism is right at the centre of a cyclonic global debate about ethics, about technology, political influence, and allegations of power wielded without responsibility. What we're seeing, I think, is the best of journalism expose the worst of journalism. What is clear, I think, is that none of us are quite sure about where it will end. But it's at its heart, it has technology: smartphones, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, iPads, and rolling 24-hour news capability, which together are changing our lives, changing the nature of public debate and public life in our country, and changing the way that news and media operate. And I thought that as we debate the inevitable tensions between personal privacy and freedom of the media and the press, and as we consider the changes that social media is making possible, I wanted to share some more heartwarming experiences of social media and reflect a little on how this technology can in fact enhance the power of quality journalism. In Queensland this year, as you all know, we had a pretty big story to tell. After 7 years of droughts, cyclones, floods and floodwaters wreaked terrible havoc and destruction right across our state. We had entire towns like the little town of Theodore evacuated in full. In the Darling Downs, the town of Condamine had to be evacuated twice as floodwaters rose, receded and then rose again. From regional centres like Toowoomba, Rockhampton and Bundaberg to very small towns like Grantham and then through to our largest cities like Ipswich and our capital Brisbane, floods left a trail of devastation and heartbreak. And then, of course, Cyclone Yasi, a monster Category 5 cyclone, made landfall in February. It devastated coastal towns like Tully and Cardwell, ripping off roofs, smashing buildings, and it affected an area stretching from Ingham right up to Cairns. Together, these disasters have cost an extraordinary $6.8 billion in damage to roads and railways and public infrastructure. They've also cost 36 lives. The world knows something of what Queensland endured. It was a very compelling story, whether it was being told by old media or in new media. But there is a largely, I think, still untold story of how technology and social media particularly helped us to communicate to prepare for, to endure and to recover from these terrible events. In May 2010, the Queensland Police Service began a trial using Facebook, Twitter and YouTube. You think of the Queensland Police Service of old and it doesn't seem likely, but one of their aims was to develop an online community of followers before a disaster occurred. They took this prophetic initiative in light of international examples such as the Mumbai terrorist attacks, where social media dominated mainstream media coverage, but authorities and news organisations were very limited in the contribution that they could make. Queensland had made legislative changes in November last year to make the Queensland Police Service the lead agency in the response phase to a disaster. By that stage, in November, the Queensland Police Service had 8,000 likes on their Facebook and 1,000 followers on their Twitter. Events would very quickly mean that they were about to experience an extraordinarily sharp surge in popularity. Category 1 Cyclone Tasha struck on Christmas Day, bringing heavy rain to central Queensland and then subsequently very significant flooding. Police media continued to issue regular media releases to the mainstream media, but they now also added those releases to their Facebook page and linked these to Twitter. Within 2 weeks, their followers had doubled. Then on January the 10th, disaster struck in Toowoomba and the Lockyer Valley. You all know about the inland tsunami that caused by freakish levels of rainfall that swept through that area. Within days, significant floods hit Ipswich and Brisbane. And by the second week of January, 200,000 Queenslanders were flood affected and 3/4 of the state was disaster declared. In the 24-hour period following the flash floods in Toowoomba, the number of likes on the QPS Facebook page increased from approximately 17,000 to 100,000 in less than 48 hours. The same day, the QPS Facebook page generated 39 million post impressions or comments, equating to 450 viewers per second over the peak 24-hour period. Within weeks of the worst floods subsiding, Category 1 Tropical Cyclone Anthony struck North Queensland and was followed very quickly days later by Tropical Cyclone Yasi. Those two cyclones caused yet another spike in the use of the police social media accounts. Given the majority of the information that the police released was factual and that it was in the interests of public safety, it could be released immediately and without any clearance process. The team was given the trust needed to use their judgment. That meant that there was an immediate response whenever they needed to. There was no directive or any policy decision to escalate the use of social media during those disasters. The police team just instinctively gravitated towards the social media channels because they were clearly the fastest and they were the best way to distribute the information as quickly as possible. Within days, not only were the mainstream media relying on QPS social media accounts as their key source of information, but they were actively referring the public to their social media channels. QPS tweets would appear in national TV network news tickers and would be read out by radio station announcers within moments of the media team publishing them online. This almost instant crossover from new media back to old media allowed the information published by the team to be distributed at a speed and to a sheer number of people that was not previously possible. People stranded by the side of the road or in their homes isolated by floodwaters, many without electricity, people hunkered down in their bathrooms under mattresses as cyclones passed over their house, members of the deaf community and people interstate or overseas all wanting information on their loved one were relying on this sort of information in this format. All of these people could access detailed, up-to-the-moment information as long as they'd charged their mobile phone. Some of the basic services provided by the police media during that time included live video streaming of the Brisbane-based disaster-related media press conferences, which were then subsequently posted on YouTube. They were live tweeting the key points out of those media briefings as I was giving them. They were uploading the summaries of them straight away onto the police Facebook pages. And they were uploading at least daily audio updates to Facebook from local disaster coordination teams. They were also myth-busting misinformation and rumours in the media and in the community. The benefits of this during a difficult and very frightening time were many and varied. It was immediate and it was used to proactively push out large volumes of information. The QPS Facebook page became the trusted, authoritative hub for the dissemination of information and facts. I can tell you that nothing spreads faster than a rumour during a crisis, and the MythBusters site became a very important part of the process. It meant that any rumours and misreporting could be quickly killed before they got legs and got some substantiation by being merely repeated in mainstream media. Mainly they did that. They actually invented a hashtag for Twitter called MythBuster, and people, when they got information, were going straight there to find out if it was true. Obviously, it provides access to immediate feedback and information from the public as well, who were using it as a two-way communication tool. And, as I said, mainstream media had confidence in using it as the basis of fact and getting information out very quickly. Another example of a very structured use of that technology was the use of our SMS early warning system. This was established nationally by all Australian states after the experience of the Victorian bushfires. Queensland's disasters were in fact the first test of this new early warning system that any Australian state's been able to do. What it did was give it gives the central statewide disaster management group the capability and the legal capacity to communicate directly to people with SMS messages. It was used during those disasters at a statewide level on 39 separate occasions. It delivered 37 warnings during the floods and used 48 times to deliver 16 separate or different warnings during Cyclone Yasi and its aftermath. Messages went to more than 4 million people, reaching as Queenslanders right across the state. It wasn't only the central government that had that capacity. Local councils were also able to use it. The Central Highlands Regional Council, which is where you find Emerald and Rockhampton, were very, very active in this space. They, in the matter of days when Emerald was flooding, they sent 7 SMS messages reaching 14,000 residents. Given the town has 11,500 people, they were also getting to people beyond the centre of town. The mayor tells me that he received a lot of feedback, but particularly noted one from a resident who was visiting in the USA at the time. He got the text over in the States. It gave him time to get to a neighbour by phone to tell him where his spare key was and to get friends to get his belongings out in time to rescue them. A very, I think, important point to remember here is that many people had their power cut off, but they could still keep getting these updates on their mobile phones. Many Queenslanders went to their cars, they started their engines, and they charged their phones that way. It was the only way to keep informed, and it was a way for them to feel that they were not alone. These are just some of the examples of the structured and formal use of the technology by government agencies and how it helped us to get very important information out, and how media, mainstream media, then used it to make news from. But social media really came into its own, in my experience, when it was spontaneous, when individuals used it to connect to each other and to people around the world. During and after our disasters, there were numerous examples of Twitter and Facebook making connections that informed and protected and empowered people. Whole organisations started as a result of these discussions at the time. One example is an organisation called Baked Relief. Baked Relief is now an established movement of hundreds of people who baked and cooked for people directly affected by the flood, as well as volunteers and emergency workers. It started with a young Queensland mother who felt she needed to do something during the floods. She understood that the volunteering clean-up effort was going to be hot, hard and hungry work, and she came up with the idea to start baking some food for those volunteers. She also understood that there were many people like her who, because of caring for small children or their own frailties, wanted to help in some way but were just not able to be on the end of a shovel and in the mud and tropical heat. She put the word out about what she was doing on her blog and on Twitter and on Facebook, and offers of help and baking came rushing in. Within just 48 hours, Danielle was coordinating 300 people who had registered and were all at home baking their hearts out. On January the 18th, the hashtag on Twitter, Baked Relief, was the number 2 trending hashtag in Australia, with #QueenslandFloods in the number 1 spot. It has grown now beyond imagining since then, and baked relief is now in the hands of hundreds of home cooks and bakers and is still reaching people who are recovering from floods and cyclones. They even went and helped out in Christchurch after this year's terrible earthquake, and the organisation is now determined to continue to support families who are affected by natural disasters. We also know that more than 80,000 people formally registered with Volunteering Queensland, which is our central volunteer organisation, during the disasters. And there's anecdotal evidence from Volunteering Queensland that social media again played an important role. It mobilised people because they mobilised their friends and their followers. And Volunteering Queensland tells us that when people registered or rang to find out how to go to somewhere where they could help, they would said that they'd read about it on Facebook or they were answering a Twitter. On a more local level, people whose homes had been affected used Twitter. They went onto their Facebooks. They sent out a message out into the universe and said, "We need help in our street." And within hours, they would then have up to 30 volunteers of what we now call our Mud Army there in the street working with them. Old media and new media intersected during the floods and cyclones, with one of our FM radio presenters, Michelle Laurie, keeping many Queenslanders informed of updates through Twitter. Laurie gathered a massive following as people quickly learned how well she was using her networks to spread information that they thought the public might need. Details about on such things as where to buy ice and where bread was still available became very critical information to people in the suburbs of Brisbane during that time. And Michelle Laurie was able to successfully disperse that to many needy Queenslanders. She was particularly active in assisting pet owners to find animal-friendly evacuation centres during the floods. During those difficult weeks, I couldn't help but be struck by how powerful these networks are and how much connection and comfort they were bringing to people. It seemed to me that we so often blame these technologies for reducing our people's skills. We worry so much about whether these technologies are desocialising our children, if you like, and how much they might be replacing human contact. It seemed that during these disasters, as these disasters brought people together, people who had politely been waving at neighbours for more than a decade suddenly found themselves side by side in each other's bathrooms cleaning out their cupboards. And there are many, many stories of new friendships being forged through those shared troubles. Equally, there's no doubt that thousands of these connections were generated and nurtured by social media, as people shared very frightening experiences, and they shared those experiences often across thousands of kilometres. Many of these groups are still in touch with each other. They're still sharing information and stories and support as they recover. It also brought celebrity power to our efforts, as famous Twitter accounts picked up on the issue. Lance Armstrong, for example, was in Australia for the tour down under. He offered to come to Brisbane and hold what he calls one of his Twitter rides. This is a fundraising event where cyclists join Lance Armstrong for a $50 fee and they go on a 20-kilometre ride together. All of that information was disseminated through Twitter and through Lance Armstrong's own account. It attracted some 10,000 riders with just 3 days' notice. It did close down the city for a couple of hours, but it raised $500,000. It also gave people direct contact with me as Premier and with their other elected representatives at other levels of government. Many mayors have their own accounts and important questions could be directly answered. I continue to receive messages from many of the victims of these disasters who joined my account during that time as they were looking for assistance. They're still in contact with me, whether they're still looking for assistance, asking questions, or more often than not, they're now just sharing some of their news about their rebuilding. In some respects, none of this is surprising or remarkable. We had a very human reaction. We reached out to each other in every way we could at a very frightening and difficult time. The extraordinary uptake of social media across every age group and every income group and every region during these events, I think, points very powerfully to the shared experience of people remembering what's really important. We saw an outpouring of humanity as people really cared about their fellow human beings, their neighbours, their friends and their community. They reached out to people in many cases they'd never met before. I was personally struck at the time, and I think many people around the country were, and people overseas as they watched what was happening, by how willing people were during that time to be openly emotional and affectionate. I think events moved so quickly that people just went with their instincts. And when it came down to it, our collective instinct was simply to look out for each other. Social media shares that immediacy. And this is the real difference, I think, between what is sometimes called new and old media. Something like Twitter has no agenda. It has no interests to protect or to promote. It doesn't find an angle because it is simply reporting immediately. It lives in the now and it can give expression to emotion in a very tangible way. And when you see information being transmitted like that, you can often, it stands in stark contrast to how we receive news in other contexts. What the circumstances did lead to were whole press conferences being broadcast live, which doesn't very often happen, and then posted on YouTube rather than just edited for a few minutes on normally broadcast evening news. An irony that didn't escape me during those days was how journalists were chastised by moments of outrage on Twitter. If they got too heavy in their questioning, those journalists became a little less combative in their questions and stopped looking for an angle. There was a feeling, I think, that the self-appointed watchdog was being watched, and it led to more responsible and, I think, informative reporting. 6 months down the track, I've had the opportunity, as we rebuild our state and we work to rebuild people's lives and their homes and their communities, to reflect on the goodwill that these disastrous events generated. They generated massive goodwill between friends and between strangers. And we experienced extraordinary goodwill from fellow Australians everywhere who saw the plight and immediately lent a hand. It's hard, I think, to reconcile all of that goodwill and generosity that I'm sure you experienced here, even many kilometres away, to reconcile all of that with what I'm experiencing right now as a very rancorous public debate. The nature of the current public debate, especially about climate change and carbon tax, seems to have has seen goodwill, generosity, and generosity about other people's ideas completely evaporate. There seems to me to be a real disconnect between our response to these events, which I believe was a very warm, real and genuine one that was very grounded in our humanity. And the disconnect that I see between that and our ability right now to listen to each other and to listen to those who are leading the public debate on these issues, not only politicians but scientists and others. Seems to me that humanity is now more connected than it has ever been. During the Queensland disasters, we saw the technology that connects us make us more human, not less. And it seems to me again that if we in this country could capture the tangible sense of community and goodwill that we share so quickly in difficult times and in crises, we would be much better placed to tackle some of the global issues that confront us, such as climate change. And I think we'd get a lot more done and we'd be a much stronger nation for it. So I hope I've left you with a couple of thoughts about some of the things that got us through the difficult times. And as I said at the beginning, as we reflect on how mobile phones can be used and misused, we should never forget the enabling power of them. So thank you.
Many thanks, Premier, to stay there. Thanks to Stockland who helped get this facility tonight. We're very grateful for that. So we've probably got 10 or 15 minutes. We'll finish no later than 10 past. So we've got a bit of time. Carol. Now, we have a microphone here, so you need to speak up a bit. Okay? Yeah. No, well, there's a microphone here, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there's no roving.
Okay. No, that's no. Need to speak up.
Okay. I'm just wondering how tourism is going in Queensland and whether or not the Department of Tourism has a is using social media at all to promote Queensland and how people are getting the message about what's happening with all the tourism facilities there?
Thanks for the question. Tourism has really suffered. It's, I think, around Australia, suffered through the GFC, suffering from the high Australian dollar, but Queensland has then been hit further by the terrible reputational damage. Everyone thinks we're still underwater and no one wants their family holiday in a place like that. So we've put very significant, an extra $12 million between us and the Commonwealth as part of our response to the disaster, and a big marketing campaign called Nothing Beats Queensland. And it's, I suppose, playing on the sense that nothing beats a Queensland beach, as well as, you know, we haven't been beaten by the disasters. And that's been a very big campaign that has generated very good bookings in the Easter period, the best Easter in places like Cairns and the Gold Coast that they've had for 5 years. So, and the Gold Coast certainly reported that a lot of that was from domestic tourists. So I think there was a real sense of people wanting to holiday in Queensland and help out, and that was, I think, there was a real sense of patriotism almost about that. Tourism Queensland has had an extraordinary success with social media through their campaign, The Best Job in the World. I don't know if you remember this, but they went out and offered the best job in the world to be the caretaker on Hamilton Island in the Whitsundays for 12 months. It went completely viral. They spent something like $50,000. It's the world's cheapest advertising campaign. They've won just about every international award for marketing. They had an unbelievable degree of success, and they followed that up with another campaign at the moment where people can enter a video of their workplace and win a $1 million holiday for their workplace in Queensland. We're in the judging phase of that at the moment, but we've had great response from around the world. But I think we're going to keep doing it tough in tourism for some time. It's a slow climb out, and people, I think, those people who had a great time at Easter, it was perfect weather, thank you. and we'll go home hopefully and be ambassadors for it. But those of you, the best thing you can do for Queensland right now is come and lie on one of our beaches, so make a booking.
You were, I mean, the events in Queensland were obviously a tragedy, but you were a star in most of Australia, particularly for those who followed the very substantial reporting on Sky News and the ABC. But since then, life's become a bit more difficult. Now, to some extent, I guess this is the Prime Minister's announcement of a carbon tax leading to an ETS in February, but also you're a Premier who's the Premier of a state which itself is experiencing a two-speed economy, whereas other states are locked out and Western Australia is booming. I guess in Queensland you've got a bit of each with a problem with your tourism industry and I guess a problem with retail. So how is a Premier like you, with a very high profile, try and manage the two-speed economy within your own state when a lot of the policies come out of Canberra at any rate?
Thanks, Jared. No, you're right. Queensland, like other parts of Australia, have had a pretty slow couple of years. It's been a tough time climbing out of the GFC, and we had two of our biggest industries, construction and tourism, hit very, very hard. They're very connected to each other. A lot of investment is driven through holiday apartments on places like the Gold Coast, etc. And they are still very sluggish. There are various levers that state governments can pull, and in relation, for example, for tourism, as I said, big investment in a marketing campaign, but we've also in this year's budget we'll double over the next 3 years our investment in events attraction, because we've got to have things that bring tourists to us. And it's actually, tourism is the biggest employer in Queensland. The mining industry is the biggest industry, but tourism is actually the biggest employer by value versus employment. So there's that, as well as the construction industry. We've put a very big stimulus into that starts in 2 weeks' time with a big home building grant for new construction. But they are the sort of levers that are available to state governments. We don't set more interest rates. We don't have some of the big macro levers, but where we can, we try and pull those state levers. On the other side of the coin, we have an economy that is going absolutely gangbusters in the resources sector. And that's not only driving a lot of growth and opportunity in Queensland over the next 12 months to 2 years, it's going to drive growth and opportunity for the nation. And it won't always be felt in exactly the same way in different places. But We have a coal mining industry that is being charged and turbocharged, really, by growing demand from our Asian neighbours. Japan continues to be our strongest importer of coal, but only marginally. It is being chased by China and India, who will overtake them very soon on current projections. These are mostly taking about 80% of Queensland's coal, and we're the largest seaborne exporter of coal in the world. 80% of it is coking coal that goes to the steel manufacturers of Asia. And as those economies grow, as those nations develop, then their demand is escalating at an exponential rate. We are set to see coal exports from Queensland double between now and 2020. So everything that's happened since Joe Bjelke-Petersen started digging that out of the ground in late 60s is about to double in the next 8 years. So you get a sense of what's happening there. We're also about to give birth to a new industry with the export of liquid natural gas, which no doubt you've heard a lot about. We have two companies that have received their state and federal environmental approvals and the approval of their global board. Their global boards gave approval in December last year. Between those two companies, between now and 2014, they will spend $40 billion Australian dollars in Queensland. They are constructing 500-kilometre pipelines. They are constructing big LNG manufacturing plants. There is a third company that has state and federal approval and is awaiting final investment decision from their global board in the next couple of months. And that figure will jump to $55 billion. There has never been a time in this country where private investment of that kind in that short period has ever happened. So we are, on the one hand, desperately chasing to keep to try to make sure we've got labour supply, infrastructure to match that level of activity in that sector, and at the same time trying to boost these other sectors. We're very confident the resource sector boom will actually drag these others with them eventually, but there's still a lag.
So we've got down there, we have a microphone now, then we'll come up down there, and then we'll come up the front.
When you say the construction industry is in a dip, I would have thought after the crisis and the disaster and with the infections among the Queensland flood relief tax, that you would have a boost in construction as you rebuild. Is this being delayed because of various factors, or is it something that is still to come?
A bit of both. In civil construction, there's actually a huge amount of activity. So road rebuilding, rail rebuilding, which is what the flood levy, for example, is actually paying for, that's started and that's going, and that's making a very big difference to those local economies. In the home building sector, new homes, and particularly those big high-rise investment units in places like Port Douglas and Cairns and the Whitsundays and Gold Coast, they are not happening because the tourism demand that drove them is still not there. In terms of other home building, at the moment, most of the rebuilding that's happening is people's homes did not... Well, some people's lost their home completely. Of the sort of 30,000 people who were rendered homeless for a period of time, a couple of hundred of them have lost their homes completely. That is, they got blown away and had to be demolished. All of the rest were structurally sound but had to be completely stripped inside. They lost their kitchens. They lost everything that you had chipboard or plasterboard is gone. And so they are getting work. Tradespeople who are the finishing trades, tilers, cabinet makers, they're getting work. But the new home construction is still a bit slow. And that's what we're hoping to pull forward with this six-month building grant.
We've got a question here.
Mr. Premier, you've been very busy, obviously, this last 6 months in particular, but as any person in your position, you'd be very interested in the ebb and flow of political popularity with elections coming along. Now, what would you say constitutes the biggest difficulty with, I suppose, a big fall in polls? Would it be the economic issues? Would it be the issues of media fairness? Or would it be a short attention span when you've got a new putative opposition leader? How would you see the issues, those kind of issues, as playing in the minds of the Queensland public at the moment?
Well, the media are always fair, so that couldn't possibly be anything to do with it. No, well, I think there's a number of factors. There always is, but the economy is a big one. And while we are sitting on the cusp of something pretty extraordinary in Queensland, that is yet to be felt to trickle down to a lot of households. And there's still a lot of, I think, uncertainty and caution and a little bit of concern and fear about what might happen for people. There's a very interesting report out today from the, I think it's the Commonwealth Bank economists, basically saying that, and this is a nation, this is a nationwide report, that our spending, the gap between our spending capability and our appetite for spending has actually never been greater. Average household incomes are increasing at a rate much, much higher than we are prepared to invest or spend. And we're saving. And that's generally a sign that we're a little nervous about whether or not the economy's quite... we can have a lot of confidence in it. And when people feel like that, I think they do look at their government, they do want something more, and they do judge them harshly. And I don't think it matters what side of politics is in power. And so that's a reality. Yes, we have a brand new leader in my opponents, and that's inevitable that they will attract attention, particularly a government that's served for some time, and I think that that's going to make for a very fiercely fought contest. Certainly a contest I'm going in to win, and one that I think is winnable, but I think will be very close and very, very hard fought, and it's equally, like any contest, it's losable, but that's not what I'm going in for. So, you know, I think given where Queensland is right at this moment, and given the potential and the promise that we have in front of us, we deserve a contest. You know, this is something worth fighting for. And I think the electorate deserves a contest from people who are hungry to lead it. So I think that's a good thing for democracy. It's going to make my job a lot harder, but I'm looking forward to it.
There's a question over there. I'm involved in a fruit farm project in North Queensland, and one spin or a two-speed economy doesn't matter if you can't eat, but agriculture hasn't had a mention of it. All states, in particular Queensland, it seems to me, are reducing the amount of government support for agriculture, support in terms of research and things like that. Is that the intention, that the direction that Queensland will go, or will there be more help to make sure we have more food for people?
Thank you, and I'm very happy that you've raised agriculture. It's also a very important part of our base in our economy. And in far north Queensland, as you know, the bananas took a very heavy hit, although I have to say not as heavy as they did in Cyclone Larry, partly because of the learnings from Cyclone Larry and how quickly growers have got back on their feet. And there's a whole lot of lessons that we learned out of Cyclone Larry that were able to be... You know, in Cyclone Larry, sometimes that lesson was learnt 3 or 6 months later. Because we learnt it, we were able to put it in place within 2 or 3 weeks, and it's made a real difference, and hopefully you'll see cheaper bananas in the second half of the year. In terms of agriculture generally, we've set ourselves a very clear target. We want to double the productivity of our agricultural sector within a decade, and we've been working with all of the major peak bodies. We think there is the next 10 years are going to be a very important 10 years in terms of research and capability around the productivity of agricultural land. We have done a number of things as a government in the last couple of years that we think place us in a very strategic position nationally on that. One of those you might be interested in, and I'd be happy to get some more information, but we had 3 state-based primary industries research facilities around the southeast corner of the state, all looking at different parts of agriculture. And the CSIRO, of course, had a couple of facilities doing similar work. We've got together with the CSIRO, we've closed down all 5 of them and built a brand new facility that brings all of those scientists together with state-of-the-art technology. And if you're working on the same thing, then you're working side by side. It doesn't matter whether you work for the State Department or CSIRO. We've done that in food and agriculture production, and we've also done it with the CSIRO in their environmental research capability and things like water quality and weather research, etc. So 2 brand new research facilities opened in the last 12 months, and I think the sort of synergies that will come from that and the capability that will give us in a research sense will really drive what we're hoping to do there. Mother Nature, of course, will always sometimes get in the way.
We're getting close to the end. There's a question here.
Premier, during the disasters, you demonstrated a new and unique kind of leadership through the public campaigns and information updates that you gave us. What is the inspiration for that?
They're hard questions to answer because, honestly, when you're in the middle of it, you just go with your gut, really. You don't have time to sit around and think and plan and draw up a strategic document. There's no recipe book, you know, page 65, mega disaster. You know, it doesn't work like that. But I think in reflection or in hindsight, probably the most important decision I made, and it really was a decision made like on the snap of a finger, was to go to 2-hourly press conferences. And it was made simply because the amount of information that we had, I just knew I couldn't possibly deliver it in a way that could be put in a 5-second or 5-minute even on the 6 o'clock news, and it was happening so quickly that people needed it before the 6 p.m. news. But interestingly, that decision wouldn't have meant anything if the media outlets didn't have the technological capability to switch to 24-hour rolling coverage, which they did, all of them, within a matter of hours. And I think even 5 years ago, that would have just not been possible. So they were able to cancel all of their programming, switch to 24-hour, get some journalists on the ground in a couple of places, and suddenly they were capable of doing interesting, rolling coverage that gave people what they wanted and what they needed. So, having said I would do 2-hourly press conferences, I have to tell you it's much harder than it looks. Sometimes there actually wasn't enough information to fill much of a press conference, and other times there was so much that it was hard to bring it back down. But it did mean that people were getting it live, they were getting it unfiltered, and I think that interestingly gave people an insight into what a big press conference is like, and it was a very interesting experience. But it was a combination of technology, and as I said, it really was just, oh my goodness, how am I going to get this information to people? We'll do 2-hourly updates, and we'll see how that goes. And as it turned out, it worked incredibly well, and importantly, gave people what they needed. But
I think that's a nice question to end on, because we've gone 10 past, so the Premier will just step to this side and just stay there. I'm never long. So I'd just like to say, on this terrible weather, thanks to the Premier of Queensland for making it, and thanks to all of you for coming out. And after this, Anna Bly, you'll be pleased to know that we're all off to book our holidays in Queensland. Because it's a great state, and you've put in a fine performance tonight talking about the media and how you as the Premier of Queensland adapted to the media and how other Queenslanders adapted to the media in one of Australia's greatest crises over 200 years. So well done tonight. We'd love to have you back in the future. I'm glad you made an important talk, and thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.